The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodkey from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will again be reading to you from the March and April 2020 issue of Discover Magazine. We will begin with a story, The Lemur and the Lioness. In some mammal species, females lead the pack. What can they teach humans? There's something amiss with The Lion King, aside from talking, singing animals. Disney's smash hit of stage and screen tells the tale of a young male lion Simba's rise to power. But in the real circle of life, lionesses lead. Related females band together for life as the primary hunters and warriors. Transient males join to mate, but contribute little else to a pride's success. The lion queens, however, are an exception. Among mammal species that live in social groups, only about 10% have strong female leaders. They include another fierce predator, killer whales, as well as bonobos, famous for their peaceful promiscuity. Humans, on the other hand, are part of the mammal majority. Our leaders are mostly male. Less than 7% of Fortune 500 CEOs are female. Worldwide, fewer than 24 women are heads of state or government, including Germany's Angela Merkel and New Zealand's Jacinda Ardern. In about 90% of non-industrial societies studied by anthropologists, only men hold political posts. It's undeniable that males have more sway across institutions, societies, and mammal species. But what explains those lionesses, literal and figurative, the females who lead? A multidisciplinary movement to study these outliers is gaining momentum. From hyena clans to corporate hiring culture, researchers are charting the pathways and barriers to female power among mammals, including our own species. Female leaders in the animal world, bullies, warriors, and wise matriarchs. In the dry, thorny forests of Madagascar, Varroa's Sifaka lemurs leap between trees with gravity-defying ease. For these primates, there's no question which sex is dominant. Females beat up the males, says anthropologist Rebecca Lewis of the University of Texas at Austin. To avoid smacks to the face and bites, males call out submissively when females approach, a chattering, chee, 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 which is the equivalent of bowing down, says Lewis. At trees laden with edible fruit, it's ladies first. If a male climbs up, the feasting female may aggressively lunge or glare, and he'll often retreat to the ground. But tensions escalate during the dry season when food is so scarce, the animals lose up to 20% of their weight. They're just really suffering during this time, says Lewis, who leads a wildlife research station in Madagascar. One source of sustenance is the fatty baobab fruit. Its thick shell takes sifakas a half hour to gouge open with their teeth. As a female works to free her own meal, she keeps an eye on nearby males. When one of them breaks open the shell, she claims the fruit like a schoolyard bully, slapping him to surrender. He might even hold onto the fruit while she's eating, just crying the whole time because he doesn't want to lose it, says Lewis. Eventually, he goes on to crack another. She takes that one too. Few mammal females attain this degree of dominance, defined by biologists as an animal's ability to subordinate another through force or threat. Among the roughly 5,400 mammal species, in just a couple of dozen do females routinely outrank males during dominance contests. These include spotted hyenas and two types of naked mole rat. But lemur species make up the bulk of the list. For more than 20 species of lemurs, including Varroa's Sifaka, female rule is the rule, not the exception. The fact that females are socially so powerful in lemur societies shows us that more traditional division of sex roles is not some inevitable destiny of mammalian biology, says Peter Kappeler, a zoologist at the University of Göttingen in Germany. That gives rise to all sorts of questions. Why that might be the case? Why lemurs are so different? One obvious consideration is what Kappeler and all others call the lemur syndrome. Females have traits that are typical of males in other mammal species. Their external genitalia are elongated, appearing more penis-like, and their bodies are the same size or slightly larger than a male's. With a mass difference of less than 10%, both sexes would belong to the same weight class in boxing. Lady lemurs also display so-called masculine behaviors, play tussling, marking territory with scent glands, and intimidating subordinates with feigned or real cuffs and bites. A similar pattern is found in African spotted hyenas. Females are larger and stronger, with masculinized vaginas and clitorises that resemble scrotums and penises. High-ranking females keep order in clans of up to 130 members and comprise the front lines during wars against rival hyena clans or lions. But body size and pseudo-penises aren't enough to explain power dynamics in these species, nor are hormones. Although pregnant hyenas and lemurs show elevated testosterone levels, most of the time adult females have lower concentrations than males, a puzzling finding scientists are investigating. A 2019 Nature Ecology and Evolution paper on spotted hyenas suggests that disproportionate social clout, rather than physical strength, fuels female dominance. Its authors analyzed 4,133 encounters between mixed or same-sex hyenas, which ended with one animal exerting dominance and the other retreating, cowering, or otherwise signaling defeat. Over 75% of the time in all matchups, victory went to whichever animal had more potential allies close enough to call for backup. And in spotted hyena society, high-ranking females have the most allies. Another 2019 study published in the International Journal of Primatology looked at several hundred dominance contests between Sifaka lemurs of varying ages. Although adult males bow down with a differential chi-chi-chi-chi to adult females, males of all ages get into conflicts with juvenile females. The researchers found juvenile females won about a quarter of the bouts and adolescents about half, regardless of body size. Adult females who had offspring past weaning age triumphed nearly 100% of the time. Sexual maturity and successful motherhood give these females status. The findings challenge the idea that male-like traits give rise to female dominance in these species. Perhaps female power, attained through social support or reproductive outcomes, led to lemur syndrome and its hyena equivalent. Lewis, co-author of the 2019 lemur study, has pushed researchers to look beyond physical dominance when investigating power relations. In her other articles, she contends that power, one's ability to make another creature do something, can be reached by alternate means or expressed other ways. Leadership is a special kind of power, influence over the entire group. Dominant animals can be leaders capable of directing collective action, or they may just be lone bullies at the baobab tree. Strong female leadership is even more rare than female dominance among animals. A 2018 study in Leadership Quarterly reviewed 76 social species in four decision-making contexts: collective travel, foraging, and conflicts within or between groups. Defining leaders as individuals that routinely call the shots in at least two of these realms, the researchers identified eight species run by females: ruffed and ring-tailed lemurs, spotted hyenas, killer whales, African lions, bonobos, and two types of elephant. It looks like there are these independent evolutionary events where the set of circumstances gave rise to strong female leaders, says lead author Jennifer Smith, a biologist at Mills College. For spotted hyenas and two lemur species, dominance certainly plays a role. But the other five species took different pathways to leadership. Female elephants and killer whales can live into their 80s in matrilineal societies, comprising up to four generations of mothers and offspring. With the most accumulated wisdom about local resources and dangers, female elders lead group movement and food pursuits. It makes so much incredible sense, says Smith. These long-lived females with great knowledge, of course they would be the leaders. Killer whales or orcas are also one of the few species in which females live decades past menopause. Orca communities especially follow these grandmothers or great-grandmothers during hard times, like when salmon prey are scarce, according to a 2015 study in Current Biology. Meanwhile, female lions and bonobos derive strength from numbers. In both species, allied females fend off bigger, stronger males. Kinship unites the lionesses, but bonobos form coalitions of non-relatives, which groom and fondle each other. Females of this chimpanzee species, through their cooperative social alliances, are in a way civically larger and more influential than one male, Smith explains. Female leaders in our own species, bias, biology, and breaking through. In the 1970s, a review of historical descriptions of 93 non-industrial societies found only about 10% permitted women to hold political posts, and women were generally less powerful than male counterparts. Contemporary scholars attribute this in part to the mentality of past researchers. Ethnographers, predominantly men from Western patriarchies, documented leadership in male-dominated domains like war, and overlooked female authority in economic, domestic, and other spheres. But even in more recent, less biased research, it hits you in the face how disparately represented men and women are in positions of leadership, particularly more overt political leadership, says Christopher Von Ruden, an anthropologist at the University of Richmond's Jepson School of Leadership Studies. Consider that Samane, indigenous people of the Bolivian Amazon who subsist on wild foods and garden-scale farming. Although Tsimane lack formal leaders, certain individuals have a greater voice in village affairs. In a 2018 Evolution and Human Behavior paper, Von Ruden and colleagues found that at community meetings, less than 10% of comments came from women. And when Tsimane ranked fellow villagers based on their ability to influence debates and manage projects, the average male score was higher than the scores of 89% of the women. And yet, consistent with global surveys, Samane political leadership is predominantly, but not exclusively, male. Some women leaders exist among them. Probing the data further, Von Ruden's team found factors beyond a Y chromosome that predicted political sway, including a person's size, education, and number of allies. The authors concluded that these qualities, rather than gender per se, elevated individuals to become leaders. It just so happens that Samane men generally place higher on those metrics than do women. For example, the female participants received, on average, 3.9 years of formal schooling, compared with 5.8 years for men. While physical differences are essentially set, gaps in education and social capital are not. Indeed, in another study of a more remote Samane village, the third highest leader in town was a well-educated woman who had studied in a larger town. Through his research, Von Ruden seeks to explain how the evolution of sex differences affect access to leadership across human societies, a topic fraught with political potential landmines, he admits. Evolutionary anthropologists, including Von Ruden, think the answer lies at the intersection of biological sex differences and the particular history, customs, and environment of any given society. Thanks to our mammalian roots, women bear and nurse babies. Men are generally larger and stronger. Just considering upper body strength, 99% of women have less arm muscle mass than the average man. These biological realities set the stage for sexual division of labor, common among cultures. Men tended to take on riskier behaviors like battles and big game hunts, which require coalitions and hierarchical coordination. Tethered to children and homes, women assumed a greater share of domestic responsibilities, forming fewer but more intimate social ties. From this evolutionary background, sex-based stereotypes emerged, which then became amplified or dampened by the particularities of a given society. For example, it's been proposed that the invention of the plow deepened gender divisions because its use requires substantially more upper body strength than hoe or stick tilling. This relegated men to fields and women to household labor. According to a 2013 Quarterly Journal of Economic Study, the plow's effects persist. The authors compared farming styles of more than 1,200 non-industrial societies with gender beliefs of their modern descendants. The analysis found that descendants of plow farmers have fewer women in the workforce and politics, and less favorable views about gender equality. For example, in Pakistan, where earlier societies relied on the plow, only 16% of agricultural workers are women, compared with 90% in Burundi, which had traditional hoe tilling. Understanding the evolution of male-skewered leadership, says von Rudin, puts us in a better position to act on behalf of putting more women in positions of power. There's a lot of catching up to do. In the U.S., while women make up half the entry-level workforce, their presence dwindles on each step of the corporate ladder, comprising just a quarter of senior managers, 11% of top earners, and 5% of CEOs in S&P 500 companies, according to a 2019 report by Catalyst, a women's leadership nonprofit. Based on metrics like wage gap, share of labor force, and percentage of women working, gender equality rose beginning in the 1960s, peaked in the 1990s, and then stagnated for the past two decades. Siri Chilazi, a fellow at the Women and Public Policy Program and at Harvard University, says company policies and structures are part of the problem, as are individual biases. For example, results of an experiment published in 2014 in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found that investors preferred entrepreneurial pitches from men, rating their presentations as more persuasive, logical, and fact-based than those from women. The catch? The content was identical, word for word. A now classic analysis, published in 2000, underscores such biases. In the 1970s and 80s, major U.S. symphonies changed their auditions so musicians played behind a curtain that concealed their identity. Prior to the policy shift, less than 10% of new hires were women. Afterward, the number of female musicians in all orchestras increased exponentially, most drastically for the New York Philharmonic, where, following the change, about 50% of new hires were women. As Chilazi sees it, research has a clear message for organizations trying to level out gender ratios in leadership. Company policies are much easier to change and much easier to debias than our human brains. Research runs thin when it comes to what is arguably the ultimate glass ceiling, elected national leadership. Starting in 1960, with Sri Lanka's Prime Minister Sirimavo Bandaranaike, 115 women have served as president, prime minister, or chancellor of 75 countries, from Brazil to Bangladesh. But as in the business world, gender gains rose steeply through the 90s and then recently reversed course. Oklahoma State University political scientist Farida Jalalzai's research shows female executives tend to serve in systems with both a president and a prime minister, often holding the weaker of the posts. Rather than popular vote, most are appointed by legislators or winning parties and into unstable posts that can be challenged. Recall the no-confidence votes Theresa May faced in the UK Parliament. Another factor, the majority hail from political families, often the wives or daughters of former leaders. Jalalzai notes that while 2016 U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, the wife of a former president, fit this profile, the U.S. presidency is a single, powerful head of state, rather than part of a power-sharing dual leadership system. The Oval Office is a tough glass ceiling to crack. According to Jalalzai, although Clinton failed to win the presidency, the campaign may have shifted perceptions about who can assume the office. A record number of women entered the 2020 Democratic primary, for example. People didn't take her loss as the lesson that women shouldn't be competing for this, she says. It showed us really the opposite. Jalalzai found similar effects globally, looking at public opinion surveys taken by 62,000 individuals from over 40 countries. In the 11 nations with female executives during the 2018 study's time frame, people were more accepting of female leaders, interested in politics, and likely to vote, especially female respondents. Other researchers have focused on local elections with corroborating results. In a 2018 Leadership Quarterly paper, researchers found that after the election of female mayors, those municipalities saw more women assuming top and middle management positions in public organizations. A study published in 2012 in Science considered the consequences of a 1993 Indian law that mandated a random third of West Bengal villages reserve their chief counselor seat for an elected woman. Based on more than 8,400 surveys collected in 495 villages. The researchers found that having a woman counselor for two election cycles improved aspirations for girls to continue higher education and politics. The girls also spent more years in school and fewer minutes per day on domestic chores. The study suggests that while gender equality does not beget female leaders, the reverse may be true. Women in high offices promote gender equality either directly through policies and appointments or indirectly by acting as a prominent reminder that women can lead. The Sound, the Fury, and Me, Living with the Pain and Pleasure of Everyday Sounds. It was the salads that got me. On nights when my parents started off dinner with some leafy greens, I left the room. The habit quickly became a ritual, and to my family's credit or not, no one ever remarked on it. It was just another quirk, like sticking your tongue out when you concentrate. You see, to me, the sound of salad was unendurable. The crisp crunching and the scrape and squeak of utensils on ceramic dinnerware felt like a personal affront, a stimulus-inducing red-hot rage inside me. I felt an inexplicable urge to hurl plates and bowls against the walls. Instead, I left the table. As I grew up and I moved away, the problem faded into the background. Not until later did I discover that there was a name for these irrational fits of anger. Misophonia is an adverse reaction to specific sounds, often in the form of annoyance that turns quickly into anger. Eating, chewing gum, and typing on keyboards are all common triggers, but it varies from person to person. Human-made noises will most often cause the reaction, and these sounds typically come from people close to sufferers, like family and friends. The condition tends to surface during childhood or adolescence. And while scientists don't know how many people are affected, a 2014 study published in Clinical Psychology found some level of misophonia in nearly 20% of the 500 undergrads studied. The severity of reactions ranges across a fairly broad spectrum, from mild to debilitating. Some people can control their symptoms with minimal difficulty, using techniques like maintaining mindfulness and telling themselves that their reaction is out of whack and that they should let it go, mimicking the sounds, or just keeping noise-canceling headphones on hand. Others, though, find themselves unable to endure even basic social situations. For me, the best correlate I've found for the reaction is getting cut off in traffic. You know you shouldn't feel so angry, but that fury is unstoppable. Misophonia was first identified fewer than 20 years ago. Husband and wife team Pavel and Margaret Jastabroff were studying tinnitus, ringing in the ears, at Emory University, when they found that some people seem to have oddly specific and intense reactions to particular sounds. A 2013 study in Frontiers in Human Neuroscience provided some validation for misophonia as a condition by tracking heightened levels of skin conductance, a common measure of bodily arousal, when patients heard sounds that triggered them. It's an indication that the sounds somehow set off the automatic nervous system, responsible, among other things, for our fight or flight response. Another group of scientists had misophonics lie in an MRI scanner and then played trigger sounds, like of eating or breathing. Compared with the control group, the misophonics had elevated levels of activity in their anterior insula, a brain region involved with emotional processing. Not only that, but their anterior insulas seem to have unusual connections to parts of the brain dealing with memory. It seems as if, for example, when they are listening to these sounds, their past experiences with those sounds are coming to bear, says Sukhbinder Kumar, a researcher at Newcastle University and co-author of the study published in 2017 in Current Biology. So a negative experience long ago that we associate with a particular sound, even if the two aren't related, might explain the ongoing fight-or-flight reactions that misophonics experience. For example, if you hate your boss and they regularly clear their throat, that same throat-clearing noise might stir feelings of anger if heard in other situations. In fact, Pavel Jastabroff thinks that nearly anyone could develop the condition. I think that I know how to create misophonia to any type of sound in anybody. I could make you climb the walls, hearing the sound of the clicking of my glasses, he says. Jastabroff does believe that some people may be particularly susceptible to misophonia. Kumar agrees and thinks underlying psychological factors may be to blame. He says we need more research into the neurological underpinnings of the condition and the complex ways environment and personal history affect misophonia. But before we begin any Freudian dives into my past, I have to let you in on a secret. Yes, some sounds inexplicably annoy me, but those same sounds, those that send my blood towards its boiling point, I also really, really like them. The sound of chewing can send tingles racing through my skull, and pens whispering against paper are mysteriously relaxing. And though I can't be with my family when they're eating salads, a stranger munching lettuce next to me is sublime. It's a phenomenon known as Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response, or ASMR. It spawned its own online industry. Today, videos by ASMRists on YouTube rack up hundreds of thousands of views. They commonly feature everyday activities narrated in gentle whispers, haircuts, hotel check-ins, makeup tutorials, and much more. Many people use the videos to help them fall asleep. Specific trigger sounds, often those at once both sharp and muted, give those who experience ASMR a wave of pleasant shivers, accompanied by a sensation of calm and relaxation. Most people tend to prefer triggers made by people, but some people report things like the sound of water running through pipes can elicit ASMR. Others don't even need sound, reacting instead to lights flashed in their faces. What brings the tingles is still a mystery. They can seem superficially similar to the sensation of chills down the spine that particularly moving music or art brings, though studies suggest that the two are separate phenomenon, and there seems to be no link to sexual pleasure. As of yet, few scientists have examined the experience, though a plus one study in 2018, looking at participants who self-reported ASMR tingles, did provide evidence that something involuntary and physiological, not just imagined, was happening. When viewing videos designed to produce an ASMR response, the participants' heart rates went down, an indication of relaxation. Meanwhile, their skin conductance levels increased, indicating bodily arousal. One of the only studies to use brain imaging to study ASMR-sensitive individuals, published in 2017 in Social Neuroscience, found changes in regions of the brain that control inward-looking thoughts related to memories and emotions. Based on this, the researchers think those with ASMR might be more strongly affected by experiences that involve both senses and emotions. Feeling happy tingles when exposed to certain sounds, then, might be the result. But what should we make of someone who experiences both of these similar yet functionally opposed conditions? Is there a scientific explanation for this auditory sadomasochism? Julia Perio, who co-authored the PLOS One study while at the University of Sheffield in the UK, says she experiences both ASMR and misophonia as well, and she thinks that's fairly common. Our working hypothesis is that it reflects an underlying sensory sensitivity, Perio says. It's that people who experience ASMR or misophonia, all of those sorts of things, experience the world in a different way. The team plans to explore the connection further. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. Again, that's area code 919-832-5138. 5138.